Hi, everybody. The more I learn about this issue, the more I'm convinced that violence is preventable. And it's been such a great relief at APHA to discover there's so many other people who think the same way and believe that also. So I work at Prevention Institute, and I support an initiative called UNITY. It stands for Urban Networks to Increase Thriving Youth. And I'll be talking today a bit more about how we take public health principles and concepts and apply them to the issue of violence. It's a little bit different than how Ceasefire approaches it, but I think they're very compatible. And even though UNITY really focuses on preventing violence affecting youth in large U.S. cities, a lot of this content, I think, relates to other forms of violence and also can help prevent violence among among different populations. So I want to start in Oakland, where I live and work, just across the Bay Bridge from San Francisco. And in a lot of neighborhoods, violence is the most pervasive part of growing up, and that has a profound impact on the lives of the children growing up there. There's been research that's just come out recently that says that in some U.S. neighborhoods, children are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder at even higher rates than soldiers coming back from combat. We call it post-traumatic stress disorder, but I think it's more accurate to call it chronic traumatic stress disorder, because for these kids, there isn't any returning home from combat. Their neighborhood is the war zone. So in addition to a lot of the mental health consequences, a lot of the trauma, violence maims and kills families and communities. It's a leading cause of injury, disability, and premature death, and it also leads to all sorts of really horrible health outcomes. So I think we can all agree that the violence is good for your health, right? If you go running every day, doctors and health professionals will all say that's good for you. But if your neighborhood isn't safe, if you don't feel safe outside, you're not going to go running, you're not going to walk around, you're not going to lead an active life. And that's just one way that violence connects to lots of other health issues. Violence and the fear of violence also affects what businesses open up in your neighborhood. So if your neighborhood is seen as violent, maybe a grocery store that sells fresh fruits and vegetables, that's not going to open up in your neighborhood. And that affects the health options available to all the residents who live in that area. So those are just some ways that violence can affect health. We also know that children who have been exposed to violence, who witness violence or suffer violence, their brain develops differently. So they're less able to cope with stress over the entire course of their lifetime. And that has health consequences too. And the other reason that violence should be a priority public health problem is that it's a health inequity. It affects young people of color, and people living in low-income areas more than for other groups. And we really wanted to examine these relationships a little bit more closely. So we actually came out with this fact sheet all about violence and health equity last year. So it's available on our website, preventioninstitute.org, if you want to learn a bit more about all the facts that reinforce this idea. So for this fact sheet, we looked at a bunch of different risk and resilience factors, kind of what are the things in the neighborhood that make violence more likely or less likely. Risk factors are things that make violence more likely. I don't think any of these are that unfamiliar to you. Poverty, alcohol and other drugs, academic failure, incarceration. And we also looked at resilience factors, things that make violence less likely and also buffer against a lot of the risk factors. What we saw was a lot of the risk factors tended to cluster in certain neighborhoods. And even though every community and every neighborhood has resilience factors, has assets really going for it, sometimes there's just so many risk factors, they kind of overwhelm all the benefit of the resilience factors, and that's when you see violence crop up. These neighborhoods tended to be in cities. They tended to be neighborhoods that had a history of disinvestment where a lot of young people of color live. And we saw the same pattern with resilience factors. So the resilience factors tended to cluster in places that were suburban neighborhoods with more white residents, and they had a lot more resources in terms of wealth and income and economic resources and economic opportunity. And so even though for people in those neighborhoods, maybe there was risk at the family level or the individual level or even at the community level, there were so many resilience factors at play in that neighborhood that you didn't see violence crop up. All the residents in that area were protected by these resilience factors. So as you might imagine, the opportunities available to young people are drastically different depending on the risk and resilience factors at play. And these are not fairly distributed in the United States today. So how does UNITY understand the public health approach to violence? One is that it's population-based. We really focus on what are those community level and neighborhood level strategies that can prevent violence for everybody, not just working one-on-one with people, though obviously that is really important. The other thing is we focus on prevention. So rather than only reacting in a crisis or only responding after a shooting, what can we really do up front to prevent that whole sequence of events from happening in the first place? We also focus on reducing risk factors and increasing resilience and protective factors, especially ones that are already doing really well in that community and flourishing, kind of building on the assets that are already there. So how do we actually do this? A lot of the strategies that we recommend are summarized in the Unity Policy Platform. We worked on this with cities across the United States to get their input, and we also used kind of the best available evidence from the CDC and other sources. And there are five core strategies. I can't go into all of them in just 15 minutes, so it's also available on our website for you to read in full. But one of those five core strategies is street outreach and violence interruption. And the reason why that's so important is when you have people building relationships in the community and mediating conflict, it creates that space to put in place longer-term primary prevention strategies that really start improving the neighborhood, start building community. Another strategy that's recommended is community building. This is a strategy that I think is great because it not only can help residents develop advocacy skills and start addressing problems like violence, but also other problems that the community thinks are important to address. So an example of this was also in Oakland, in the Sobrante Park neighborhood. And the city and the county decided to fund an initiative that would promote bartering in the neighborhood. So let's say I give Elizabeth a ride to the hospital for her doctor's appointment, and that takes me about 2 hours, right? I'm sitting in the waiting room. I'm able to log those hours with a local church, which tracks all the hours in the neighborhood, and I can spend those 2 hours later on maybe to have a qualified neighbor babysit my kids for 2 hours. And so it's a way to kind of build on what's already working well in the neighborhood to, you know, build relationships and connections so that all those residents can start working together toward a common goal. So other aspects of this initiative are annual health fairs. So these are the Sobrante Park elementary cheerleaders, showing how they can be physically active and live healthy lives. And there are lots of other components to this program, like mentoring and job training. And it's all associated with a 40% decrease in violent crime in that area. We also encourage our the cities that we work with to prioritize a bunch of these strategies locally. These are strategies that can support the five core strategies. And it's really a way to honor kind of practitioner wisdom and also to take into account the local context and the local history. Violence looks different in every city and every community. And so these strategies are meant to kind of really honor what the community and what the residents say they want to see changed. A lot of times there's a big emphasis these days on evidence-based programs. And we always remind our cities, you know, and Greta will be talking a lot about that next, but we always remind our cities, you know, it's okay to try new things. It's okay to listen to your residents and be innovative and be responsive to them, because evidence-based practices, it's what we know works right now, but it's not the universe of what could work. So we really encourage them to kind of work from the ground up and also kind of from the top down, if that makes sense. So the Unity Policy Platform is just one way that we work with policymakers at the federal level, at the state level, to make sure that the work that they're doing is supportive of the work on the ground. We also provide training and technical assistance to about 22 cities, and we're funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to do this work. We're in our eighth year of our cooperative agreement. And another thing that we do is to facilitate the Unity City Network. So in addition to providing, you know, one-on-one tailored assistance to cities, we actually also bring them all together so they can share success stories, learn from each other, give each other advice, and really be inspired by all the work that's happening across the country to prevent violence. And we also develop different tools and frameworks depending on their needs, like the Unity Roadmap. And this really describes what's really needed in addition to just the programs or the policies. This describes kind of a lot of the infrastructure elements and the support elements, like data and evaluation, like high-level leadership, like community engagement. So we know that prevention works. We've seen it happen with car seats and safety belts, with no smoking laws, with vaccinations. And I think that the issue of violence could really benefit from prevention experts, and that public health has a unique role to play for this issue. A lot of times I've given this talk, and people will look at this list and they'll say, what? Like, these things were easy, right? Like, it was easy to get all this, and violence is different. Preventing violence is impossible. And I think we're all here to tell you today that you're wrong. that preventing violence is possible, and that it's happening in cities across the U.S. right now. And I think Kobe already talked a bit about what's happening in Chicago, and I want to talk a bit about what's happening in Minneapolis. So, what's my time? Do I have time? So Mayor Ryback, he's the mayor of Minneapolis, and he said that the only way he's been able to authentically connect with survivors of a tragedy like a murder is to imagine that his own children had died. And he realized in one summer that he had, on some level, experienced the death of his own children 9 times. And, you know, he said, we're doing something wrong. Like, I can't do this anymore. And he decided to start exploring other approaches besides law enforcement. He learned about the public health approach, and he worked with the city council and directly with residents, with young people, to pass a resolution, declaring youth violence a preventable public health problem. He personally oversaw the development of a strategic plan. It really involved lots of different sectors of the city, city government, young people, community groups. And as a result of all that work, they saw a 64% decrease in homicides in just 2 years. And they also saw the youth suspects in violent crimes drop by 62%. So it's definitely possible to prevent violence. And in Minneapolis, they're really building on this momentum. And that good work is continuing today. And you'll notice here that it's not just about a particular program or a particular strategy or even like a particular mix of strategies. The message is not to go and replicate what Minneapolis did to a T. It's really about thinking, you know, what's going to work for your community, and also to think about those other elements that support long-term success, like high-level leadership, like funding, like strategy, you know, having a plan where everybody knows how they contribute to solving the problem together. That's really kind of the key to long-lasting impact and a sustainable change. We actually have a whole publication series about success stories that's happening in U.S. cities. I think we have one on Chicago. And the fact that we have all these great stories to share and that you're here to learn more is just more evidence for me that it is possible to create safe communities everywhere in the United States. There'll be a session tomorrow at 2:30. That's going to be talking more about the Unity approach, if you'd like to come and learn more. And I'm happy to share about our frameworks and tools after the session, too. Thanks.